All right, good morning, everyone. My name is Jennifer Crow, and I'll be moderating today, which is little more than telling you what's going to happen and then wrapping it up at the end.
Now, we're going to make you work. We're going to get into a fight. You're going to have to break it up.
Ooh. Oh, that'll make it interesting. At any rate, this is session 325, titled The Borderland Sessions for Those Troubled by Church Programs, Practices, and Policies, Ways to Respond. So you've heard this before, but before we begin, we have a few announcements. We ask you to silence your cell phones and to be respectful and attentive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine and podcast at the registration desk. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. All right, so about this session, most LDS members encounter church programs, practices, and policies, or PPPs, that bother them. Example, the inability of non-temple recommend holding parents to attend a child's wedding, policies related to children of same-sex couples, and practices related to the Word of Wisdom. This session will explore some of the more troublesome PPPs and offer thoughts on what we can do to help influence appropriate change and how to make our lives more pleasant until such troubles have been resolved, either in our minds or in the church. So we have two presenters today. We have Dr. Jeff Burton is the author of Sunstone's longest-running column, Braving the Borderlands. He also authored For Those Who Wander. And Stephen Carter will finish up the session, and he is the director of publications for Sunstone Education Foundation, editor of Moth and Rust, Mormon Encounters with Death, and author of Mormonism for Beginners. Now I turn the session over to them, and we'll have some question and answers at the end.
She's going to go get her coat. I tried to get mine, but I didn't have one in the car. I'm Jeff Burton. By the way, I'm not a Dr. Jeff Burton. My first name is David, and I go by D. Jeff Burton, so it's not Dr. Jeff Burton. And also, the book that I've written is called For Those Who Wonder, but you probably know that. And as he mentioned to you today, we're going to talk about different ways we might respond to these troubling church programs. We list them as programs, practices, and policies. By the way, I'll use the short term PPPs in my talk here. First, it may not be obvious from what you see at church, but most members encounter church PPPs that bother them. Many rarely say anything. So we at Sunstone are not alone in seeing these problems and wishing for changes. It's pretty common. But where can we find a lot of these PPPs? We can go to Handbook 1 and Handbook 2 for one place. You're probably familiar with those. They list hundreds of PPPs that local leaders are supposed to know and follow. Incidentally, older versions of these handbooks were called the Handbooks of Instruction. They were secret and for leaders only. And they were instructions from the First Presidency. That put a lot of pressure on local leaders to toe the line. I mean, I've been in Bishop Bricks, and I know the routine. There wasn't much flexibility in those days, or so many thought. Today, they're known simply as handbooks, and they might be seen as more like guidelines in some minds. That implies a little more flexibility for local leaders, and you can find them online now, and they aren't secret. But because they can be a little bit more flexible, we might see some more changes at the local level where we need to have change. And I'll give you some examples. excuse me. There are other PPPs that are just in our traditions. There's a lot of them. They're right waiting there. For example, always wearing your Sunday clothes to church meetings and Sunday best, that kind of thing. And taking the sacrament with your right hand. I mean, we could list on and on and on and on in the traditions, too. But moving on, what are some common PPPs that have troubled us, those of us here in the borderlands, those of us you know, who have questions and doubts and so forth. She mentioned the examples we've talked about, you know, not being able to go to a temple wedding. We know about the policies related to same-sex couples, children, and of course practices and policies related to the temple recommend interview. Those are the ones I hear quite often, and I help people to figure out what to say in their temple recommend interviews and things. But there's lots of things you could come up with too, I'm sure, that bother you or have bothered you in the past or your friends. By the way, if you found a way to deal with some difficult PPP, you might share your story with us at the end of our session here. In the few moments that I have, I'll explore some troublesome PPPs and then offer some thoughts on how we might respond. Then, of course, I'm going to suggest how to make our lives more pleasant until such troubles have been resolved, either in our minds or in the church itself. I've noticed over the years that when some folks can't deal with these issues, they really get worried and get upset and angry. And some feel so angry or frustrated or alienated that they go inactive or they leave the church. And a few are invited out after they've made vocal or public complaints about leaders or leadership decisions or policies. We've seen that in the last couple of years with prominent Sunstone people. But then on the other hand, you know, lots of us and lots of members bite their tongues and do nothing, simmering in their discontent. You know, some say, well, it isn't my stewardship, and if things are wrong, somebody else will have to take the blame. Some just decide, it isn't that big of a deal. Sometimes it isn't. Or they try to ignore or forget about it. Personally, I'm concerned about these common approaches. I've seen too many people hurt and angry, with some flying away from the church and away from friends and away from families even. I think we should instead try to influence things for good and help change to come when it is warranted, of course. And we can be wrong, too, about our assumptions. Keep that in mind, too, as you grapple with a PPP. Taking a little time to think and study the problem, you know, from the borderlands if necessary, can be very helpful. I guess two questions I want to cover right now are, one, does the church change its PPPs? Do we have any changes in the handbooks, for example? And two, can anything we do or say bring about such changes? Some would say no to both questions, and I understand how they can come to that conclusion. But actually, a lot of change occurs, much of it without fanfare, and the church doesn't. The church does listen to members' ideas and their experiences and suggestions. For example, the correlation department has a research division which administers surveys on behalf of the leaders and administrators. These surveys often become the basis for a lot of subtle changes that sometimes aren't announced. I learned about this, and I got involved some years ago in one of those surveys. I had given a paper here at the Sunstone Symposium, my first. It was called The Phenomenon of the Closet Doubter. Was anybody here at that time? Well, what are two people? It's in my book, For Those Who Wonder, by the way, and I brought a few copies here to give away if you'd like one after the session. It's also available as a free download on my Borderlands column. It's forthosewhowonder.com. So I actually got an invitation to meet with some of these folks downtown at church headquarters, and they told me about a survey they planned to conduct to study the number of doubters in English-speaking wards. Somebody was apparently in my session from the church and went and told them about it. And so it turned out in the end about 15 to 25% of active members who took the survey probably were doubters to some varying degrees, you know, all the way from closet doubters to, I wonder about tea, I wonder if I could have a little tea, you know, things like that. But recently the church was asking for input on how to improve its hymn books and the music. It was online and on one of their websites. So yes, they do look for input, and sometimes they use that input to justify changes. I've seen that myself. So on to the next question, how much change actually occurs? The website LDS Living recently wrote about 15 major changes that occurred in 2017, including changes in temple policies and more. So you can look that up on LDS Living. What about all the recent changes in home teaching and visiting teaching? And in the priesthood quorums, those were pretty major changes. So yes, the church does change. Unfortunately, we don't get to see the processes they use to decide on the change. And that's one PPP change I would like to see. More public openness on how the church makes such decisions. Let's see how they went about it. Incidentally, I served a service mission a few years ago. Yeah, I did. I actually had an office downtown of the church office building. I saw firsthand the corporate structure of the church, and in my opinion, it is second to none. They do their corporate homework. And yes, I was writing the Borderland columns and working at Sunstone, too. Nobody down there seemed to mind. They knew about it, but that wasn't a problem. Maybe something for you to think about. We better move on to the next question. Can we help influence change, and if so, how? The answer to this is yes, even as Borderlanders. I think as long as we're still involved in the church some way, it helps. If you'll forgive me, I'll share a few of my experiences and thoughts. The first PPP I ever encountered that I disagreed with and that I tried to do something about was when I was a young missionary in Japan. After about a year there, I'd become concerned and even frustrated about the impact of current mission policies and their practices on these new starry-eyed missionaries coming into the field. You know, they come in with that prepackaged fervor and idealism they have and so forth. And being assigned to branches in season with seasoned and often tired and jaded missionaries regularly killed off their enthusiasm. I had seen more than one disappointed elder go home early and many others adopting bad habits. For some reason, I felt a bit responsible. I don't know why. I felt a little bad I wasn't doing something about it. Next Sunday, after having these thoughts, I was sitting in our hall waiting for Sunday school to be again, and the Japanese members were arriving, and there was that happy Sunday background noise we all recognize, you know, the young, happy, jabbering voices, children's banter, loud greetings across the hall, and so forth. But I was kind of into my thoughts, and I bowed my head to say a little prayer, and I said, kind of to myself or to God, what can I do about this new missionary dilemma? And this is the weird part. Suddenly the room went quiet, or so it seemed to me, and I heard a relatively loud, deep, authoritative voice say, "Follow the president." Yeah, follow the president. I heard that. I thought I heard it. Of course, I was startled and curious. I looked around the room. The chapel noise was still there. No one else had heard that voice. Obviously, in just a few seconds, this experience for me was over. As you know from reading my books or Borderlands columns, I'm a born skeptic. From early times, I've questioned everything. I like everything to be logical and rational and explainable in concrete, tangible, mathematical terms. I'm a real left-brainer. I'm an engineer. You know, that's my background. So in some ways, though, this has been a blessing. It might even be my spiritual gift. I don't know, having this doubting, having this skepticism. But here I was with a potential spiritual experience. I had heard what I thought was a message, or so it seemed to me at the time. The origins of the voice are still a mystery to me. If I have any time afterward, I'll maybe make a little bit of talk about that, what my thoughts on that are. But my attention quickly shifted. Forget about its origins. What about the message? What did that mean, follow the president? So some might interpret follow the president as sit back, don't think about it, don't act, it's not your problem, leave it to the leaders. But to me, it didn't occur to me that way. I thought it meant get some information to the mission president, let him take the proper action. That was my first thought on it. And so that day I wrote a letter about my thoughts and ideas and sent it to the mission president. In a couple of weeks, I received a call from him that he too was concerned and he would start a pilot program to put new missionaries in special branches where they could be kind of shielded from some of the negative stuff they were experiencing now. And he also changed some of the policies and practices of the mission, which, you know, I was happy with too. Interestingly, our branch was the first to participate in this new program. Three missionaries were soon transferred out of our branch and three new missionaries arrived. We were the test site for this new program. Yikes. But that's another story for another time. But things went okay. Let me say that. And these new policies were quite welcome to me. He gave us a little more freedom about what we could do about missionary work and so forth. What really helped me. So over the years, though, I have generally interpreted this message to mean, let the proper authorities know what you know and what you think could be done. Be honest, but don't be rash or hurtful. Let time and care take its wonder, work its wonders, and have faith that right will prevail. And that's how I still think about it. Follow the president, but give him some data and some suggestions. Give him some information. So when the church was going through its pains over the black soil, the priesthood thing in the early 1970s, I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan. I had several negative experiences related to this policy. I was a 70 at the time. I remember the old 70, they had elder 70 and high priests. I was a 70 at the time, so I was working with missionaries and stuff. So the first thing that happened, a choice and loving family had been baptized, really nice family. They only found out about this blacks policy afterward. I was supposed to explain it to them. Needless to say, my words didn't have much effect, and they quickly left the church. That was a sad moment for me to see them go. Another time, a new convert told me, I think it's great to keep those N-words out of the church. This was the type of people that policy appealed to, at least in that one person. On another occasion, at a campus meeting to explain Mormonism, the meeting degenerated into catcalls from the rear of the hall from several blacks who well understood that they weren't worthy of full fellowship in the Mormon church. So I was really feeling embarrassed, frustrated, and angry about the policy. And that mysterious message, follow the president, kind of tempered my frustrations. I was able to survive by writing of my experiences and thoughts to several general authorities. My bishop soon called me to talk about it. Obviously, he had received some word back from downtown. And we both decided, he was on the same page as I was. We both decided, kind of, this can't last. Let's just wait and see what happens. Another time in early 1980s, after coming home from a temple session, the ceremony seemed especially unchristlike to me and unloving. And so I wrote an essay that contained both some potential criticism of the ceremony. And before I submitted it to anybody, I sent it to two apostles asking them what they thought and if I could publish it. And I was, you know, also giving them information. I was thinking maybe killing two birds with one stone by sending it to them. But I was actually thinking about giving it to Sunstone because I was helping Peggy Fletcher at the time. The essay was sent back to me via my stake president with, you know, instructions not to publish it, of course. In both these cases, I just waited and hoped and trusted that my small efforts merged with the efforts of many other people and maybe studies done by the church would eventually have some effect. And things did change for the better in both cases, as we know. The priesthood ban ended in 1978, and the temple experience was greatly improved, starting about 1990, doing away with, you know, the slitting of throats and all that kind of stuff we used to have. Over the years, there have also been times I've disagreed with my stake president or my bishop or other local authorities. And I've served on the stake high council. I've served in two bishoprics. I've been a branch president, among other callings, over the years. Most of the time, I've let the message guide my responses, and it has served me well when I did. Sometimes my comments and suggestions were accepted by those in local authority. Sometimes I was unaware of some nuance or detail, and so I avoided personal embarrassment by simply talking to them and following the president. And here's another personal story. When I got married, my wife's parents were not LDS, and my parents didn't have temple recommends. So they wouldn't be able to see us get married in the temple. So I went to my bishop and talked to him, and we figured out. And so he arranged for us to get married outside the temple in the morning, and then that afternoon, go down to get the temple ceiling. And that seemed to be acceptable to everybody. And then, of course, we had our regular reception that night in the ward house. So how he did that, how he got permission to do that, or if he did, I don't know. I'm not sure, but my story isn't all that unique. Other people have told me that they've had similar experiences. So it doesn't hurt to explore and ask and look for your options when things come up at the local level on PPPs that you may be having trouble with. So to sum up, here's what I recommend you do when you have issues with PPPs. First, wait a bit. Study the issue as much as you can. give us some time. Second, talk it over with your spouse and parents or friends or somebody that might be able to help you think through this thing. And, you know, sometimes your friends will say, well, here's what we did in our ward. Oh, that sounds like a good idea. Next, you know, speak to your bishop or stake president, see what they have to say. Then if it's still an issue for you, write a letter. Send it to one or two apostles by name. And then send it to the church headquarters for forwarding to them. And make it personal. You know, include your experiences and so forth. I've done that a number of times, and it's paid off in some cases. This stepwise approach has worked well for me because sometimes the bishop helped me understand the issue better or in a different light, and I could see I wasn't quite on light there. Sometimes the message from the general leadership came back down through my local leaders to me. And I've even had some personal correspondence with general authorities. They've actually contacted me directly, including most recently Elder Holland. Now, that doesn't happen very often, but I think they appreciate our thoughts when given in a kind and thoughtful and helpful way, if you think about it that way. If you you'll likely get someone's attention and bring an issue to them that might result in changes in the future. Now, criticizing and complaining about the church on the anti-Mormon websites probably doesn't do as much good, but I'm sure someone down there at corporate headquarters is monitoring all of them and making reports to get to the brethren eventually. Looks like my time's almost up, but let me just say one more thing in closing. I should make a mention of my thoughts about the origin of the message, follow the president. Could it have originated outside my head? No, not by any natural means. No one else heard the voice. There was no sound pressure wave hitting my eardrum. So whatever it was, it had to access my brain's hearing centers in some other way. It might have come from God or angels by some mechanism unknown to me. I don't deny that possibility, but quite frankly, I'm skeptical of that. It just as well could have been my right brain talking to my left brain, telling it to chill out. You know, that's okay too, and more likely, who knows? Maybe it was a message from God. If it was, thank you, God. Whatever the message has worked for me in many cases, and it might work for you too. I look forward to hearing your comments and your responses and your questions, and I'll turn the time over to Stephen now.
Actually interested. Jeff mentioned the surveys and things that the church does, and I actually somehow got onto a regular email that they send me like every month or so asking my opinion on various things that have nothing to do with each other. Is anybody else in here on that particular email list? You're on it too? So we got one other person in here who just receives these things out of... I have no idea how I was chosen, but I'm interested to see that I'm still on it, considering how cantankerous I am when I write back to them.
You weren't chosen.
Well, that's interesting. I was wondering how many people are a part of that. All right, mine's going to be kind of different from Jeff's. And I hope it's not... We'll see what happens. So as I reflected on what I was going to say in this presentation, I realized that one of the most important tools I personally have had during my sojourn through the borderlands is anthropology and sociology. Now, the main reason that they've been so important to me is because they've saved me from that most Mormon of sins: believing that I'm right. Believing that we're right is something that Mormons, we tend to carry it with us our entire lives, even, and maybe even especially, when we go through a faith transition. So when we're Orthodox, we look at the world around us and we say, oh, how ignorant they all are. If only they had the truth like I do. I mean, I spent 2 years absolutely in that mindset, right? And then when we start into our faith transition, and often for a long time afterward, we look back on our Orthodox years and say, oh, how ignorant I was. It's only now that I'm seeing the light, right? I totally understand that feeling. I've harbored it myself for a long time. You feel like you've finally taken control of your vessel away from Mormonism and you've started to steer it yourself, right? Charting your own course. However, I'm going to argue against that. My basic argument for this paper is going to be that we aren't nearly as in control as we think we are. But don't worry, it'll get better toward the end. But at first, I'm going to annoy you. Okay? For the first 2/3 of this paper, I'm going to annoy you. But it'll get better, I promise. I'm going somewhere useful. So, I mentioned anthropology and I mentioned sociology as being two of the main things that kept me engaged with the LDS Church. So let's start with anthropology. When we think that by breaking out of the Orthodox current, we're doing our own thing, thinking our own thoughts, making our own discoveries, the fact is, a huge part of the direction that we're taking is actually dictated by cultural cycles that have been going on for millennia. So the reason you're probably in the borderlands, the reason I went into the borderlands, probably has something to do with something that you read or heard, probably online, or if you're weird or old like me, something you read in a paper. So much has been said about the explosion of information that the internet has made available over the past 10 plus years and how that glut of information has led to a huge exodus away from religious communities and especially conservative ones. But of course, this isn't the first time that this has happened. We can look back into history and say, oh, this happens when particular conditions are met. So the development of the printing press did exactly the same thing that the development of the internet did to religious communities. Before the printing press, the masses had no access to books, so you could only get your information by word of mouth. And this made for a culture where the privileged classes had access to information, which they passed on in ways that best suited the perpetuation of the culture. So when the printing press made the printed word available more generally, all kinds of shifts began happening in religion. It was basically... Can you hear me? Can everybody hear me? Okay. It was basically the birthplace of Protestantism. We had a huge monolithic religion that basically ran things up until then, and then suddenly, with the glut of information, pow, there were all these new interpretations. So the same cycle happens whenever more information becomes more readily available. Think, for example, about the Camelot years in the church historical department, and then go buy Leonard Arrington's diaries. You know you have tons of time on your hands, and you need to read 1,500 pages. I'm looking forward to it. So during the Camelot years, the information that those brief years made available gave a greater number of people material to interpret Mormon history. It wasn't just in the hands of a particular institution. And that led to the New Mormon History and to publications such as Dialogue and Sunstone. And the church leaders saw a microcosm then of what would happen 40 years later when the internet came to pass, which is why they re-restricted access to those archives. From an anthropological point of view, they were simply giving themselves a few more decades of relative cultural stability. So that's the basic pattern. More information leads to more interpretations. It's always been that way. And now, let's add wealth to this situation. If people have a little more time on their hands that they're not using to eke survival out of the land, they usually spend it on myth-making. In other words, developing stories and rituals to encapsulate cultural knowledge and give cosmic meaning to their lives. When they get a lot of surplus time on their hands, they either make those stories and rituals very complex, or they start formulating alternative ones. This is one of the reasons why Brigham Young kept the early saints so busy. It took away time from developing alternative interpretations. It's the same reason the church today demands so much time. The devil finds work for idle hands. So, if we look at the past two decades of American history, we can see that we've had both an explosion of information, availability, and wealth. We've had the time, the resources, and the information to create an unprecedented amount of alternative interpretations. This is especially evident in tight, high-demand cultures such as Mormonism and other conservative religions. Now, part of the strength of these cultures, part of the strength of Mormonism, is that we have a single cultural narrative that everyone adheres to. It allows them to communicate and organize efficiently. They can get things done quickly, and they self-police because the rules are so clear. So then, when alternative interpretations start to crop up, they make the culture run less efficiently because lots of questions are being asked, and those questions are being taken seriously by the larger culture. So more time is spent in conversation and deliberation, and less time is spent on action. However, of course, we're here at Sunstone, so we've got to say rah-rah for the alternative interpretations, and there are reasons for alternative interpretations. They're an important part of a culture's ability to react constructively to the world as it changes, keeping the culture healthy and viable. So this is the basic tension that runs through every culture. There's the coherent force that's trying to keep the culture running efficiently. And then there's the expansive force that's trying to help the culture interact constructively with the changing world. If either one of them takes over completely, the culture destructs, either collapsing under its focused gravity or dispersing for lack of gravity. I mean, really, what would happen if Sunstone was in charge of the church? All right. So since you're here at Sunstone, it's very likely that you identify mostly with the expansive force right now. But anthropology shows us that both forces need to be in play for our culture to work. We got to have something to push back against. Wouldn't we be just a little bit disappointed if we didn't have something to push against? So you and I are simply part of a social dynamic that's playing out in every culture. We're not special. All right, now let's head to sociology. So there's the sociology of knowledge, which basically argues that you tend to believe what the people around you believe. This is hard to swallow. It was really hard for me to swallow. You can often track the movement of your beliefs with the amount of time you spend with a particular community. This is the reason that the LDS Church has invested so many resources into building and maintaining the institutes of religion on all the college campuses. When you head to college, away from home, away from your ward, you can become immersed in an academic worldview, which rarely has time for the religious worldview since it has so little basis in empiricism and in the scientific method. So if a Mormon student spends 4 to 8 years immersed in the academic community, their beliefs will naturally shift in a more humanistic, empirical direction because their religious beliefs become less relevant in the community that they're in, less supportable in the community that they're in, and simply, in the end, less thought about until those beliefs just sort of evaporate if the student doesn't actively reject them altogether. So the church went through a great deal of time and expense to make sure that these students continued to interact with their religious community, not because that interaction would convince them logically of their religion's doctrines, but because simply maintaining their social connection with the religious community was often enough to keep their religious beliefs stable. You tend to believe what the people around you believe. So the church made sure you spent enough time with the Mormon community. Incidentally, that's also the reason why people become such devoted Fox News fans. They have continuous contact, 24/7, with the stream of information. I'm sure the church would love to figure out how to do that. Okay, so now I can see what you're thinking. you were going to church with a bunch of Orthodox Mormons while you were headed into the borderlands, right? Yes, but that's only one of the communities that you were interacting with. And it's likely that your ward was receiving less and less of your time. Think about the amount of time you spent interacting with blogs or podcasts or books or periodicals that represented an expansive point of view. Did you spend as much time with the Relief Society as you did with Feminist Mormon Housewives? Did you spend as much time in priesthood as you did listening to Mormon stories? If you tally it up, and if you're honest, you'll see that you spent much more time in these alternative spaces than you did in actual church activities, which, considering the amount of time Mormonism demands, is quite a lot. So, now you're here. Not because you've struck out on your own path, not because you've become independent, but because you spent enough time with particular communities and because information and economic conditions made room for alternative interpretations. Can you see what I meant earlier about how this presentation was going to get annoying? Basically, I've argued that we're all in the borderlands here largely because we were caught up in social currents that have been catching people since the beginning of civilization. You're more like one leaf floating down a river that's been running for a millennia. But you haven't all left me now. Thank you. I'm getting to the constructive part now. Don't let this keep you up at night. It's going to happen to generations to come. So, the interesting thing is, these very observations have been the things that have been most useful to me. Every time I start to feel superior, every time I want to denounce somebody, every time I want to write an angry letter, I also have to send it through Jeff first, and he says, no, no, Stephen. Every time I want to give up on all the stupid people, I remember that I'm caught in a giant social current as well. That if I shifted communities, my beliefs would shift as well. That if the information and economic current changed, so would I. But we tend to put ourselves in the center of our story. We think of ourselves as being the active agent. It's human nature, and it has an evolutionary purpose. However, it really does blind us to how much the culture around us drives what we do and what we think. See, as long as the culture can keep you thinking that you're in charge, that you're doing all this of your own free will, that you're the hero, you'll never see how the culture uses you. As I was writing this, I thought, oh my gosh, this sounds like the Matrix. We're all trapped in this virtual world, and only a few souls find their way out. And then I thought about it some more, and thought, oh no, actually, the funny thing is, the Matrix is actually one of those stories that the culture has developed to keep us inside the Matrix. So did you notice that when Neo escapes the Matrix, he found out, oh my gosh, I'm the chosen one! That's the oldest trick in the culture's book. And it works almost every time. Because the more you think you're the chosen one, the more you think you have secret access, the more you're in the grip of the Matrix. It doesn't care what kind of story it has to tell you to keep you inside. The more you think you're special, the more the culture's got you. All right, nourishment. But don't give up. There is one more element that is just as important as those first two. But it's only useful in their context. You really do need to be aware of how much cultural forces shape you in order to get something from this. Here's my third element. You always know when you're being nourished. When I first wrote that, I thought that I was overstating my case by saying, you always know when you're being nourished. But the more I thought about it, the more I'm willing to stand behind it. As I looked back over the times when I was truly nourished, I realized that there was no mistaking it. And this is how I realized it. I'd been to so many church meetings, especially General Conference, where someone gets up to the podium and says, "We have truly been fed by the Spirit this day." And all I could think was, I've been bored this entire time. What's the matter with me? But I'd been hearing these guys saying that my entire life. And I just assumed that something was the matter with me. And, of course, I had plenty of people who were willing to agree with me on that point. They were like, you only get out of it what you put into it. Or, if the talk wasn't good, you should write a better one in your head. Or, you're expecting too much from the church. I'm like, this is the only true church on the face of the planet. It's Jesus' church. How am I expecting too much from it? That was a long time ago. Then I sat in on my first Unitarian Universalist meeting. No, I'm not trying to make you go to the Unitarians now. And I heard their customary welcome, which says, come, come, whoever you are welcome here. No matter your age, your size, the color of your eyes, your hair, your skin, you are welcome here. No matter whom you love or how you speak, you are welcome here. If you come with a loving heart, an open mind, and willing hands, you are welcome here. So when I heard these words, my soul opened up in a way that it never had in a Mormon church meeting. I realized later that I was getting a taste of what unconditional love might feel like. And I also realized that I had never felt that in an LDS church meeting. Your experience may be different, but that was my experience. Another one of those times when I realized that I was being truly nourished rather than somebody just telling me that I was being nourished in an authoritative voice from a podium was at the Sunstone Symposium. My first one, I lived in Wyoming at the time, and I told my wife I'd only be gone 2 days. I'm just going to go to the Thursday and Friday thing. But at the end of the second day, I called her and said, this is the most amazing thing that ever happened to me. Can I stay an extra day? And very sweetly, she let me stay. And then another one of those times was during one of the many Sunday school courses that I taught while I was the Sunday school president. I've talked about my experiences in those Sunday school classes a lot on the Mormon Matters podcast and also in the magazine. So I want to take those three experiences. I haven't gone into them very deeply because I've talked about them so much in other places. You've probably heard me talk about them before. But I want to take those three and say, now what was nourishing me? What was the common element that brought them all together? Why did I react so differently to those situations than I did to all the LDS meetings where somebody had told me from the pulpit that we had been spiritually fed and I felt famished? And I realized that it wasn't because of the content of the meetings. It was because of how I could be in that community. So the Unitarian meeting was the first time that I had ever heard anybody explicitly say, the whole you is welcome here. Not just your socially acceptable parts, but all of you. I've never heard that in an LDS church meeting. Even though a speaker might talk about the love of God or Jesus' forgiveness, it was always in a repentance context. It was always like, yeah, I know that you're imperfect, I know that you sin, but you can become pure. So I was broken right now, and I could become pure. I could never be wholly there. I could always be there as a broken person who needed fixing. So at Sunstone, I was among people who had been, for the first time, I realized that I was among people who had been through similar difficulties to mine. And they were people who were also willing to admit that they wandered, like Jeff was saying, and that they were willing to be a fellow traveler with me. They said, oh, you're lost? I'm lost too. Let's walk together. I'd never felt that before either. I was always among people who said, oh, we know where we're going. You don't know where you're going? Let us show you. So that companionship was priceless. Then, in my Sunday school lessons, I had specifically designed them to make my class members feel safe in being themselves, rather than having to hide behind their Mormon veneer. So once again, the nourishment wasn't coming from the content of what was happening in either in any of those three contexts, but from the fact that the conversation invited everyone in. So, we know we are being nourished not because of the content of any given situation, but because of its structure. We can feel that our true selves are not only welcome, but actually essential to the life of the group. Our uniqueness, which includes our shadow self, adds to the group's potential. An extra dimension becomes possible because we are there. We aren't there so that we can offload all of our sins. Our sins are actually, we can talk more about that later. Our sins can be assets. So this sense of community, of acceptance, is the thing that pulls us, in my opinion, out of that cultural current that I was talking about. This sense of community is the thing that frees us from the dynamics of economics, information, and history. Expansion and coherence, those two opposing forces I was talking about, aren't important when people are together in community with each other. It doesn't even come into play because the subject of our interaction isn't information or morals or principles or organization, but each other. We're nourished not because we have the right beliefs or we say the right things or we perform our callings, but because we've become a larger organism whose every part is essential. Of course, Paul described it as the body of Christ, which, he pointed out, needs its dishonorable parts every bit as much as it needs its honorable parts. We tend to forget that in church. We say, leave all those dishonorable parts out. So, I've come to my suggestion part. My observation is that for most Intermountain Mormons, it's very difficult to find this kind of nourishment, this kind of community. We're so caught up in the content and structure of the church that becomes our religion. Think, for example, about the testimonies you've heard over the past few months in Fast and Testimony meeting. Even though many of them include a personal element, they inevitably end up being presented as a piece of information for one argument, which is the church is true. Though we don't usually say it in so many words, we understand that our testimony isn't valid for its own sake, but only insofar as it supports the church. It's the same with church talks. They're all structured to act as evidence for the argument that the church is true. We bend our experiences and beliefs toward the end of maintaining the church. Our individual selves are important only insofar as our actions and beliefs support the church. We always have to be examples of the church, especially in our meetings. So what that means is that we've essentially made our church meetings almost impenetrable to community. And it ends up, ironically, that the best place to find community, the best place to find nourishment in the church is in the 12-step programs that it sponsors. Because by our very presence in those 12-step meetings, we're outing ourselves as not good examples, as people who need help, as people who don't meet the good Mormon criteria. And that changes the basic tack of the conversation. Instead of presenting ourselves or our experience as one more piece of evidence for the church being true, we talk from our heart to a non-judgmental crowd. The purpose of the conversation is not to support the church, but to support each other. That is the essential difference between church meeting and 12-step meeting. Support the church, support each other. So as I said earlier, there is a way to create this kind of space in regular church meetings. I could do it using a set of principles that I've talked about on episodes 379, 380, and 413 of the Mormon Matters podcast, if you want to go listen. Okay, episodes 379, 380, and 413 of the Mormon Matters podcast. Now, I want to acknowledge that this communal nourishing experience isn't the only one that needs to go on in church. We still need to run administrative meetings and plan activities, but I still think that most Mormons are starving for community without knowing it, simply because it's only ever accidentally provided. So I want to offer a few suggestions on how to get this spiritual nourishment and how to make that nourishment more likely to happen in your LDS ward, especially if you're not in a leadership calling or teach or anything like that. My first suggestion is to... I've got 10 minutes? Okay. Well, we have 10 minutes in the whole session, so I got to shut up. Okay, I'll go through these fast. My first suggestion is to find a place that nourishes you, a place where you are accepted, where you can come into community with others, and where you can leave refreshed and optimistic. For a lot of people, this is the LDS Church. For me, it's not. For you, it may not be. If it's not for you, find that place. Find a place that can eventually fill you enough so that you can say, yeah, I could go to my ward and make a contribution there. In order to do that, you have to have extra energy instead of just enough to make it through one more tiring three-hour block. It's also essential that you experience a nourishing atmosphere for long enough to learn what it feels like and what goes into making it. You'll know you found the right place when one weekend your spouse and kids are gone and you still get up to go, because by gum, you like it there. Second, give yourself a calling in your ward. Not just any old calling, one that takes into consideration all parts of you. One that sounds like fun. One that makes you a little bit vulnerable. One that your bishop would never approve of. For example, one of my callings is to talk during church classes about gospel lessons I've learned from R-rated movies. Number three, dress funny. I know that we talk a lot about how we dress in our best at church in order to show our respect toward God, but I'm not convinced. I think we have our dress code so that it's easy to hide. We dress to look like we're good Mormons, to set a good example, and therefore, to not be ourselves. To avoid falling into Satan's clutches, I suggest that you avoid the appearance of evil altogether and dress weird. It doesn't have to be too out there. For example, I wear a colored shirt and no tie. And that makes me slightly uncomfortable in that sea of white shirts and conservative ties. But the reason I do this is because something interesting happens to me when I don't quite blend in. I'm more willing to put myself out there. I can do things that require a modicum of bravery because I'm already out of the groove. It's true that you're not going to get on any short lists for bishop or Relief Society president if you do this. And there are other perks, too. All right, so the basic point of this presentation is that when we're interacting with the church, the most constructive way to do that is to interact with church members. And the most constructive way to do that is to interact with the church members in your immediate vicinity. And the most constructive way to do that is to deliberately make room for everyone to not only feel acceptable, but valuable as they are. Only then will we start to interact with each other instead of as examples of why the church is true. And often, you will have to spend a few social rules to get yourself into that kind of place. But as on an airplane, when the oxygen masks come down, put one on you first so that you can help. Find a place that nourishes you, and then bring a little of that nourishment to the starving people in your ward. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm tired. Are there any deacons that can bring this? Okay, you can bring up.
Yeah, come and speak at the.
Yeah, there's about 7 to 8 minutes left, so we have time for about two questions, perhaps.
Whatever.
So.
Yeah, let's see what happens.
So, come on up to the microphone if you have a question.
So how many times did you fail along the way as you're trying to come up with this process for yourself to be nourished and to work through? Because I'm like anything, right, Edison, right? You fail 1,000 times. Okay. And sometimes in the church environment, that those failures actually take a lot of valuable resources away from your ability in the future then to participate and do that.
It's totally true. Yeah. I first went down this path when I read a book by M. Scott Peck, The Road Less Traveled Guy. It was one of his lesser-known books called The Different Drum, and I read about community, the way he was describing it, and I felt this deep, ravenous hunger for what he was talking about. And so I knew what I was looking for at that point. I highly recommend this book. And then I got into, I did my PhD in education, and I learned about pedagogy and how to manipulate people in large groups and put together the principles from that. I said, oh, there's actually principles for bringing people together. And most of the time, the thing that got in my way was my ego and me wanting to get content across to people rather than creating a space where people could be themselves. And I also found out that I had to throw myself to the sharks first before anybody else would. I had to become vulnerable first before anybody else would become vulnerable. I couldn't go out there and say, all right, be whole, be vulnerable, come on, let's be a community. I had to let go of everything first. So that was basically the process. I read that book, I learned about pedagogy, and then I learned that I had to sort of lead the way or jump off the cliff first. Did I answer your question? Is that good? Okay. A Different Drum.
A Different Drum.
I was fascinated by your comment about the 10-step program, and I've heard really good things about that. Now I'm thinking about attending. Has anybody attended and had a great experience? I'd be interested to hear, because that sounds like there's a great community there. I mean, to your point, I really like that.
Does anybody want to talk about that?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
12 steps.
Oh, I don't know how many steps it is.
Just answering your question, my sister Diane is one of the facilitators. And on the addiction recovery and stuff program for the church. She says it's the most beautiful meetings you've ever been to. She says the spirit is always there and there's so much love. And so it's like Stephen's saying that she says, because everyone is trying to open their heart to God and let go of a lot of things. Do you know what I mean? There's so much personal, beautiful stuff happening. And she loves all the people so much. And they all love each other. And so yeah. So the church's addiction recovery programs and stuff? Awesome.
Except you're not supposed to attend them unless you share their addiction. And just so you know.
So develop an addiction first.
Generally, most AA meetings don't allow family. Yeah, but the church and they're patterned on each other. And some of the church ones I know don't allow family members, so maybe some do. I don't know how to articulate this, and I don't know if it's a comment or a question. I always thought there was some missing spiritual gene or something in me, because you articulated it very, very nicely about that sense of disconnect, because I was always taught, Jesus loves you, but, you put the nail further in his hand every time you sinned, and I always, did the rest of you hear that? And brethren, and so when you were talking about community and love, some people seem to feel that tremendous love from God or Jesus that I always felt was conditional. Just saying. And, like an evangelical preacher tried to talk to me to come join, and he couldn't understand because he says, I'm in constant contact with Jesus loving me. Don't you have that need? And I thought, no. I mean, I don't get something external to myself providing my sense of love. But to evangelicals, they often get caught up. So the brethren love me. I've never particularly felt. So I don't know what the disconnect, but you really did that nicely about where do you feel nourished. But some people seem to be nourished by that external. The brethren love me. God loves me. Other people don't. How do you understand my dilemma, or am I being really unclear?
No, I totally understand where you're coming from on that, because I've felt the same way. I rarely felt the love of God. We have 2 minutes. What about you, Jeff? Did you ever feel the love of God?
All the time.
Okay.
So what makes it so that you feel the love of God and a lot of people don't?
Oh, I have no idea why I don't feel the love. No, and see, one of the things that I was kind of pointing out is that it was the communal aspect that really nourished me. It wasn't the love of God, unless I suppose the love of God was manifested through the people around me. But I don't know. I'm willing to say that the love of the people around me was what was nourishing me, the unconditional love.
You got anything to say about that? That's good. I don't know. I think about it for myself. I think about my life every night when I'm saying my prayers. You know, how blessed I've been all my life, so many ways, and I can't help but think that God has some influence on that somewhere, some way.
Thanks for keeping us from getting struck by lightning, Jeff. I appreciate that. Are we done? Okay. Come up and talk afterwards. Okay, thanks, guys.
Hold on just 1 second. We were supposed to read one little paragraph.
So, during lunch from 12:30 to 2, signature book authors will be signing copies of their books, all of which are available from Benchmark Books. Tables are set up near the Benchmark Books concourse. And there will be Gary Bergera.
Yeah.
Yeah. Confessions of a Mormon Historian, The Diaries of Leonard J. Arrington. Stephen Carter, Moth and Rust, Mormon Encounters with Death.
Don't get
that one. Deja Vu, Early to the Mormon Newlyweds Who Thought the Belly Button Was Somehow Involved. D. Michael Quinn, The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Corporate Power. And Daniel Stone, William Bickerton, Forgotten Latter-day Prophet. So be sure to check those books out and go meet those authors. Enjoy lunch in your next session.